Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Andrew Yule, author of the new book, The Blackjack Insiders. Also joining us is Anthony Curtis, who just happens to be the publisher of this book. Gentlemen, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Before we discuss the book, Andrew, you're a regular contributor to the Gambling with an Edge website. Tell us about what it is that you write about.
Thanks, Bob. I just try to write about kind of the inside perspective that a lot of people don't get to see with the Question of the Days and with the Gambling with an Edge blog both. Just try to write about kind of a point of view that maybe people haven't thought of or maybe a point of view that's changed over the years. You know, a lot of the business is changing. So I think it's important to try to get that new perception out there of what the climate in the casino world is like today.
We should point out that you are a floor man or pit manager. What is your position now, currently?
I'm a floor supervisor and sometimes a manager as well.
Okay.
And this is, you know, I can comment on this. You know, when we first, Andy was discovered by Dee Castleman, who's been with LVA for a long time and, you know, does a lot of Question of the Day. And they got to be buddies and he said, I've got this guy and he's on the inside. And I said, that would be great. I mean, does he know his stuff? Because not everybody on the inside knows their stuff. He goes, yeah, I think so. And so he did a couple of answers, and I said, you cannot put them up until I take a look at them. And I took a look, and they were good. And then one thing led to another that way.
Yeah, I would have thought he would have asked Richard and me if we could put him on the website because it's called Gambling with an Edge. It's kind of our site, but no. But
I would always hear from you. If it didn't work, I would hear from you. I know that.
We're good. So, Andrew, there's a lot of blackjack books on the market. What makes your book unique?
Kind of the dichotomy between being a player and then being on the floor and being in the casino too. The addition of kind of the drama at work and how to navigate that. The differences between working at the casino and then going and playing for them a couple hours later. And then using that kind of inside knowledge and just the knowledge of what the supervisors are doing and what might be going on in surveillance and why the dealers might be doing this instead of that. Those kinds of things are kind of it's hard to find in a blackjack book for sure. It's a new perspective.
I always thought it was almost impossible to find, and that's why I wanted him to. When we started talking about the possibility of a book after he did some answers on Question of the Day and he did some blog posts, I said, could we possibly bridge this whole thing between what players see and what the pit is thinking? You know, that was what it was all about. Now, where else are you going to get that? You know, you talk to everybody that we know that goes out and plays and you go, everyone's got an idea of what they're doing in the pit. And unless you end up, dating one of the pit girls or something like that, you're just not going to get that information because typically you don't really get friendly with these guys so much. And then we took it to another level where Andy was actually going out and playing, so he wasn't just like, okay, we're over a beer. All right, how would you handle this? Well, this is what we would do, blah, blah, blah. He actually went out and played and did it and was able to watch. And I said, all right, I've never seen this before in a book. And that's what I think, made this one different.
Did you ever get heat from your work for being out playing?
I suspect that some of the higher ups kind of knew what was going on, but we never really got talked to or anything about that. They were pretty good about, what you do on your own time is kind of your own business. They were good about that.
I knew a guy who got fired for card counting. I mean, he was now this is going back years and years, but he was a dealer at the Dunes and he went out counting cards and he got barred at a casino and they called over to the Dunes and the Dunes fired him because of it. So.
Yeah, but that was the casino pressed it though, right? Wherever he got thrown out of, that puts you in kind of a bad spot, I reckon.
Yeah,
They hadn't pressed it and they just knew about it, would they care? I mean,
no, probably not. Yeah.
One place I worked, they asked me if I had been over to a certain casino recently, and I said that I hadn't, and I guess my picture had come across my boss's desk. And they thought that somebody else that was playing and counting, they thought that was me and it wasn't. So that was a little bit funny. It wasn't me, but they kind of thought it was. So they were asking me if I'd been playing or anything lately.
But they knew that you were out counting. They knew that you counted cards.
I had stopped playing by this time, but yeah, they knew about my past.
Oh, this was after.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I was gonna say you didn't play that. You played only for a while till you got your feet underneath you before you guys were out, right?
Right, right. And I had a couple of different stints where like I stopped and then. You know, I'd pick it up again a little while later, and this was after one of those.
Now, do they ever come up to you and say, "Hey, we think that guy's counting. Go check it out."
Yeah, they sure do. It's a good way to not bother surveillance with watching somebody for a long time because it takes them a lot longer to compile the data and stuff like that. So if they suspect somebody, yeah, I'll check them out for a few minutes and.
By hovering close or by doing it from a distance, or
I can not too close. I mean, you don't want to be hovering right over somebody.
3 feet, huh?
Right, right. Yeah, I can watch the game pretty casually from I don't know 10 feet away and get a pretty good feel within a couple shuffles.
Well, have we said where you work, or is that not? We're not saying that.
That's up to Andrew.
Yeah, up to you.
I think it's pretty common knowledge at this point with my work on LVA that I work at the Cromwell.
Okay, well, I was going to say, because if you want a history of sweating, that used to be the Barbary Coast.
Right.
I mean, was there ever a greater sweat joint? Maybe the El Cortez.
Yeah. El Cortez, for
but
sure.
I mean, Barbary Coast, boy, that was sweat city.
Well, I shouldn't say that. They were very fast to bar people, but if they thought you were not counting cards, they actually would let you win a lot of money.
That's true. You know what? You know, sweat could be either way. It could be sweating the money, sweating a loss, or sweating somebody who's good. They used to sweat good players.
Yeah, yeah.
Big time over there.
All the pit bosses had to learn basic strategy and how to count cards. And, yeah, they would throw you out right away. Even nickel players, like 5 to 15 or something, you know.
That's at the Barbary?
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard stories like that. A little before my time.
Yeah.
When I was a dealer, I would occasionally get asked to go check out a player who they thought was counting cards. And invariably, it was somebody I knew. And so I would just go up to the... I remember one... I went up to the table and I said, "Man, you know, you're putting heat on me." His name was Arthur. And
probably still is.
It still is Arthur, yeah. And I said, "Man, you're putting heat on me." And he goes, "I'm putting heat on a pit boss? How can I do that?" I said, "Well, they want me to come over here and see if you're counting cards." And, you know, so it was actually single deck. And I looked down and the first round goes to like +6. And he goes, "Oh, sure." Right. Yeah. Like, and I said, "Well, you better play one more hand, you know." So he shoved out all his chips. He caught a blackjack. He got up and left. So then when the boss came over and asked me, like, you know, so was he counting? I was like, he played one-handed left, so.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
That's perfect.
Well, I did that once. I was with Peter Griffin, you know, the great Blight. Not Peter Griffin from The Family Guy. So for all young people who are listening to this, the great Peter Griffin, blackjack expert, theory of blackjack, all that kind of thing. And Griffin and I were hanging out at maybe the Slipper, Silver Slipper. You dealt there for a while.
Oh, just for one night. I was on the extra board, and so you could go to either the Slipper or the Castaways.
Okay, well, I walked up, and Dustin Marks was dealing. All right, wow. Now, Dustin Marks is the author of our book, Cheating at Blackjack. And I said to Peter, I go, "This is another name." And I said, "He's really good with cards." And he's looking at me, he's shaking his head. "No, no, quiet. No, don't say, not now." You know, that sort of thing. You know, Peter and I had a couple of Heinekens. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, this is this guy. But yeah, those things used to happen back then.
Yeah, it was a much smaller world for advantage players back then. Everybody kind of knew each other.
Well, Dustin was a card mechanic, wasn't he?
He was an amazing card mechanic.
He still is.
Yeah, so he still is.
You would... advise Peter not to play there anyway.
Well, the thing is that what I didn't know at the time, I knew who Dustin was, and I knew that he was really good with cards, but I didn't know he was dumping from the inside. I mean, if you read, we'll promote some other books, not just yours, but I mean, if you read Cheating at Blackjack, you see what his modus operandi was to work with outside help. The outside help was working with the inside help, being him, and he was, you know, dealing cards and seconds and things to the players themselves. So,
to an agent.
To an agent. He might have been right on a play.
And stealing
right
from other players.
Basically, yeah. Well, stealing from the house, really. But yeah, they had to cover what's taken from other players. Yeah, I didn't say Dustin was a good guy. I said he was a really good mechanic.
Okay. Now, Andrew, let's go through a book a little bit. Basically, one of your bosses, you call him Mark Stevens. That might be his real name. I don't know. But you call him Mark Stevens, kind of shows you the ropes on blackjack, and later becomes a partner of yours. How did this all work out? You can spend some time on this if you like.
I mean, I talk about it a lot in the book, but just a quick kind of story about it is we took a basic strategy test just to kind of see where all the floors were at. And, you know, that's kind of something that doesn't really happen a lot anymore, but that's what we did. And he was impressed with my results, even though it wasn't perfect, but it was ahead of the curve, so to speak. And I don't remember how it came up exactly, but we were talking about card counting, and I told him I'd always kind of wanted to learn how to do it, and he said that he would work with me. And he just started kind of giving me little assignments, you know, to first, of course, perfect basic strategy, and then we went through the running count, and I had week or so to practice that, flipping through cards and all that stuff. And, you know, that grew into the true count and different little drills to keep the true count. And just step by step, it turned into this thing where I was ready to come into his office and we'd practice on my breaks and his breaks. And, you know, we'd go through shoes and practice betting patterns and all these different things. And it just kind of turned into this thing that we both wanted to try. We both wanted to try it in Vegas and see if we could pull it off together. He'd been kind of playing by himself. And, you know, he told me he would bankroll me because that was an issue for me at the time, was bankrolling. And
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you were a recently single father.
Yeah, recently still going through the divorce at the time. And so I didn't really have much of a bankroll to speak of. And he pitched the idea of bankrolling me. And he kind of explained that I wouldn't make as much money as if I was a real investor. But that, you know, that wasn't an option for me at that point in my life. So that's what we did. And it went so well that I decided I could scrape some money together and make it a partnership. And it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing.
And is that something, you said they gave you a basic strategy test. Is that something that happens nowadays in casinos?
The last one I took was that one in the book.
Oh,
and that
okay.
was 8 years ago.
And was that just him that decided to do that, or was that a casino policy?
To my knowledge, that was a Mark thing.
So you know, the answer is no. They don't.
Yeah,
do,
they don't do that. Although there's when my son got out of high school, I got him a job in a casino at 18. You could in California, there were some casinos, and they gave everybody coming into the dealer school basic strategy. And I got a call from someone connected to the casino and said, "This is the first time ever that one of our students told us that our basic strategy was wrong, that we were teaching everybody." So, they had the wrong basic strategy chart that they had been testing everybody with. So,
that's pretty common, I think.
Does that surprise you? And then
No, it doesn't. Yeah, that they had the wrong chart.
That's pretty common, I think. There's a lot of misconceptions. We all know that. A lot of misconceptions about basic strategy out there. And there's a lot of different charts. And some of them are even wrong for the rules that they're set up to be.
You know? Right. No, this was an easy error to make where it was the casino hits off 17 instead of still.
Right, right.
You know, so they had.
This has always been amazing to me, you know, in my business now. Obviously, I meet a lot of people that are executives or people, you know, even at parties and things, and they know my background. I publish these books, and they'll start telling me their concept of counting cards, and they're never right. I mean, the people from the industry, I almost are never right. I mean, once in a while, sure, there's a person, you know, Andrew, but they're almost never right. They've got very strange ideas about it.
Not just that. I mean, it used to boggle my mind when I worked in the casino that a guy could be in that industry for 30 years and never bother to learn anything about any of the games. You know, they would make fun of players who bet in the field in craps, but thought nothing of the guy betting crap 11 or something. You know what I mean? So
yeah, not just the absence of requirement to learn it, but the absence of ambition to learn it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're going to watch the game for 30 years, you would think you would want to know something about it.
Well, I've experienced that as well with people I've talked to. And I think it's just that they think the time on the job is their teacher and that's it. And they form these ideas and opinions and they feel they could write the book. let alone right. why would they read one? And they've never really read the mathematics about it, and they've come up with some faulty assumptions, and that's what they've lived by all their lives. That's what I've seen for, you know, 3-4 decades here.
It's yeah. easy to talk about the staff that way, the bosses and the dealers, but I think it's the same way for the players, like the people that have been playing blackjack for 30 years. There's every table's full of those too, right? And they say almost the same things about how they've been playing this game for so long. They know what this is going
to
be. They know what that's going
to
be.
I used to get that from my father. You know, I had been a dealer and a boss and was working as a professional gambler, and he would come up with this stuff that, oh no, he knows it's true because some judge he knew in Chicago has been coming to Vegas for 40 years, you know, so.
Right, right.
Yes, and I was told that the house always wins by somebody who knew, because this guy who could buy me over many, many times told that. So he had to be the expert. I was going, just because you're rich in life does not mean you're knowledgeable. So
true blue.
All right. Now, as your journey progressed with Mark, you both end up not keeping your full-time casino jobs.
Correct.
For different reasons. This turns out to be good news, bad news for you. Tell us how this went.
It was good news, bad news. It was bad news. Nobody wants to lose a job. Nobody wants to lose the stability of a full-time job. But it was good news because it kind of forced us into a position to make a decision. We had to decide if we were going to find another job or if we were going to try to make this playing thing work for a little while and try to see if we could take our act on the road a little bit, because you can't just play in Vegas every day. So that's what we did. We decided it would just... For both of us, you know, he was going through some things in his life at the time, too. So for both of us, it was a time where we both wanted to travel, get out a little bit, do something different. You know, we'd both been wearing suits and ties to work every day for a long time. It was the idea of getting out of there and having the freedom of not having a schedule and being able to make a little bit more money, because, you know, we were making more money playing cards and making $18 an hour standing floor. So... It was an intriguing thing that we both just wanted to take advantage of, and really glad that we did it. We got to see some things that we never would have seen if it wasn't for this. So yeah, it was definitely good news in the long run.
So when you hit the road and you would go to, I don't know, let's say Arizona, was that a state you played?
Mark played in Arizona.
Certainly Seattle.
Okay, so Seattle. Would you use a player's card, show ID, or would you play anonymously?
At that point, we were playing anonymously because we were both in all the
databases.
All the databases already. So we were playing anonymously by that point, yeah.
And so what happens when you're on the floor and you have a player who wants to play anonymously? Does it immediately trigger I need to look at this guy?
The act of not playing with a card by itself is not a trigger, because a lot of people don't want to play with a card, especially if they're playing kind of lower limits, and some guys just don't want to be bothered, and some people don't want the mail, and, you know, there's a lot of reasons that people don't play with a card. But for me, when I start to piece that together with the other things, that, you know, the betting patterns and the behavioral stuff that I see that a lot of other people wouldn't be able to see, then the combination of those things becomes a trigger.
Of course, you're going to know instantly, right? Anybody who knows how to count cards is going to know somebody else is counting cards.
Right.
So let me interject. This is the very reason we wanted to do this book. And
yes.
I mean, these were the kind of questions that we wanted answered. And I can tell you that when I went through the first draft of this, Andrew had answered many of them, you know, to my satisfaction. But how many marks were there on there saying more? Or how many marks were there on there saying, okay, in this situation, what were you thinking? In this situation, what did you remember or see? And right? And that's how the next draft came, and that's how this book came about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't tell you how many people tell me, oh, you have to use a player's card these days. You can't play without one. And so now we're hearing...
Well, I think
it's not an automatic trigger.
I think it kind of depends on where you are, because, you know, I work on the strip. So if somebody's saying they don't want a player's card, I mean, there's thousands of people that are coming through there every day. But if I raised a little suspicion in places that had smaller casinos, like Seattle, for instance. All the rooms up there are pretty small, and they thought it maybe was a little strange that I didn't have a player's card. So it does kind of depend on where you are, I think.
Yeah, but and if they think you're a local. Obviously, if they think you're a local and not taking advantage of what they're giving away, it becomes more suspicious than if you tell them, I'm just passing through town. So
right, and in my case, I was there, you know, when I'd make these trips, we'd be there for 8 to 12 days. So the first day when I didn't want a card, it was one thing, but then you get into the second, the third, and the fifth day, and...
Looks suspicious.
Yeah, a little bit suspicious. But most of them were nice about it. I even got one of the bosses to comp my meal, even though I didn't have a player's card. He found a way to make it work. So it depends on where you are and who you're dealing with.
And what about hat? Hat or no hat?
I say hat, but I don't believe that it makes much of a difference.
Well, have you looked at... You obviously are in the databases. Have you looked at your own photos?
I have seen my pictures, yeah. One of them, I have my hat on backwards. I never even do that. I wonder how they caught that picture, but...
That doesn't help hide your face.
No, I mean, it sure doesn't.
If you look at surveillance photos of a guy wearing a hat, I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying you shouldn't wear a hat when you look at a surveillance photo of a guy in a hat, because you just can't see his face.
Right.
You know?
It's a little bit different, I think. The hat thing, like, I wear hats anyway, so it's easy for me to say just wear a hat, because it makes it harder, but it doesn't, I don't think it deters them from getting the picture. There's so many different camera angles and so many different, the software is so advanced now that if they want a picture of your face, they're going to get it. It's just a matter of when. Does it make it harder to get it with a hat? Yeah, it probably does a little bit, but I don't think it's going to deter them much.
Well, it hides stuff, like it hides your hairline, whether you're balding or not, or whether you're a lot of things with your hairline is a way to recognize somebody.
Right.
And a hat on would disguise that.
Yeah, like I said, it helps. It helps for sure.
Now, as a floor supervisor at the Cromwell, if somebody has a hat on, does that make you extra suspicious?
No. A lot of people wear hats, you know, not just card counters. A lot of people wear them, and that's not the kind of stuff that makes you want to look at somebody.
So, I often could see people walk in the door and know that they were, if not a card counter, that they were up to something. Do you experience that?
It's definitely more... Like, when I catch a card counter, it's not usually because I'm running down the deck and realize, hey, this guy's counting cards. It's something like that, something about him, something behavioral. Like, and most of it is just from, like, what I used to do. Like, oh, I used to do that when I played, or I used to look at the discard rack like that, or I used to, you know, it's small stuff like that, along with the betting patterns, of course. But I don't even start running down a deck on somebody and unless I see red flags like that.
Is your procedure for you to do it, or for the boss to call surveillance and have them do it?
Do the rundown?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good idea to get surveillance involved, too, for sure. I don't know if there's an exact procedural outline anywhere, but it's definitely a good idea to communicate with the whole...
Because I'm thinking about your peers, right? Because your peers probably can't run down
correct.
A player.
Correct.
So for them, you don't think there's a procedure in place that says...
I mean, they're advised...
Call?
When I say procedure, I mean like a writing. They're definitely advised to call. Everybody should call. They encourage communication for almost every reason, especially that one.
Now, how much was being a... We've partly answered this before. I'm going to give you a chance to answer it more fully. How much did being a casino employee help you as a player? What could you do as a player that you would not have done had you not worked in a casino?
What could I do from the player side? So I guess I just understood the behaviors a little bit more. I kind of already talked about this from the floor side about knowing what the behaviors of the player look like. Well, it's the same thing being on the other side of the table. Everybody has this kind of perception of what they think heat looks like, but you know, sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's something else. So, you know, when they're coming over to tap on the computer screen by you, I can surmise by the situation what's going around me, if it's about me, if it's about the guy next to me, if maybe there's like a financial threshold that he's trying to check on, maybe it's a behavioral thing. I guess I just had a little bit of better understanding of things like that. And when the phone rings and when they go to the phone, why is it ringing and why are they talking on the phone? the phone scares most people when the phone rings. Every card counter is like, oh shit, that's about me. But that's not normally the case. You know, they're not just up there watching card counters. They're watching a whole bunch of different things happening. So just the understanding of different behaviors and what was going on in the pit, for sure.
You know, the last two books we did on Blackjack Insiders, Andrews, and Colin Jones's 21st Century Card Counter. What struck me with both of those is how aggressive both of these groups were. It was just two of those guys, and Colin was, you know, playing with a few other guys, but they were all so aggressive. And I kind of, my feeling was in reading these books and then talking to them afterwards, was that in Andrew's case, just kind of what he said, you know, he kind of knew how far he could go and then made a decision and said, okay, I know what's going to happen. Once they got me, they got me. So I'm going to get out of here. I mean, you can tell me, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but it seemed like that's what I got out of the pages there. With the other guys, they were just like, there's so many places to play now, I just don't care. So it's funny that same idea runs through both books. It's just play aggressively, don't worry about it. They're not going to hurt you. You know what? We used to think when we played, we might get hurt.
Yeah, and you were right.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and we were kind of right about this. And yeah, these guys, there's always like an undertone of it in their books, but it's almost like they know, look, the worst that's going to happen to me is I'm going to get scolded. And I think that's what's changing, like this new breed of blackjack player, is they're kind of getting it, that they don't have to worry about the things that we used to have to worry about.
That's the casinos have faced repercussions for it. So, yeah, the right. Physical danger is just not... I'm not saying it can't happen, but it's a lot less... possible.
It's much easier to avoid now than I imagine that it used to be, for sure.
Yeah. And people have asked me, like, because I've never been back roomed, and I attributed it to the fact that I worked in the casino, because I just felt like I usually would see the heat happening before it actually came down, and I would just leave.
And you could probably navigate the relationship a little better. When they did approach you, you probably knew what you could say and what you couldn't say. And
yeah, the other thing that freaks people out is a guy in a suit comes into the pit and starts talking to the pit boss, and they're both over there looking at you. And then the guy approaches the table, and it turns out he's a host. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
But
yeah. Got that. That story's in here.
That story is in the book, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, that's happened to every player, right? I mean, but, you know, there are players who would get up and be out the door before the guy could come approach you, and now you've just kind of backed yourself off.
Well, with both of these, that was one of the key sort of themes going through it, is don't back yourself off. Even right. More so in Colin's book, he keeps saying it, don't back yourself off. And I think that I used to back myself off a lot, you know, right. And I think that was really a big mistake. I left a lot of money on the table by doing that.
I tend to be a little bit more careful in Vegas, I'd say. But when I'd start traveling and, you know, when I was in, say, Mississippi, for instance, I knew I wasn't going to go back to Mississippi. Like, I knew what my plan for this was. And I could be more aggressive because I was just going to play until they told me I couldn't play anymore. When you're somewhere, especially that you don't think you're going to be back to, or that you know you're not going to be back to, just go all. There's no reason to hold back, you know?
Yeah, that's the theme I'm talking about, you know, and it was very evident. But it's also kind of cool that in some places you see that, you know, Andrew Yule kind of loses his cool a little bit, and he loses his composure. And I mean, as I'm reading this myself, as I'm editing it, I'm going, really? It scared you too, even at some point, you know, where you got a little bit, got caught off guard or something. So there's a little bit of that in the book too, which makes you as a player go, okay, it's okay. You know, you can get scared. You can get nervous sometimes. It happens to everybody, right?
That's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to be relatable. A lot of the stories that I've read don't touch on the fears and like how, you know, you shake a little bit when you get that tap on the shoulder, security approaches you, and how hard the losses are. And things like that I don't think get talked about enough. I definitely wanted to touch on that. It is scary, you know, when you're surrounded by security guards and in a place you've never been before, and they're all trying to push you in one direction. It is scary. There's absolutely.
And the losses, you know, sitting in a hotel room in the middle of Iowa in the middle of winter, you know, after getting your brains beat in. I mean, it really sucks, and not enough people talk about that.
It can suck, for sure. You know, you're not just the losses, but what you're putting yourself through to go through those losses. A lot of times you're sitting in these horrible chairs. You know, a lot of places don't have nice chairs anymore.
Smoke.
The smoke, which was great about Seattle, by the way, non-smoking. But you had the smoke and the just the people that you have to deal with, the people that are getting on you for your play, and just the combination of all that thing can be really hard to deal with, especially when you're losing.
Yeah, well, it seems like this is kind of unfair to Bob Dancer, leaving him out of the discussion, because there's probably no big swings of fortune in high-stakes video poker, right, Bob?
Right.
And you know, another thing that I dealt with, and I don't remember this in the book, but dating was a real difficult thing for me when I was out playing full-time, just because... You know, you go out on a second date and you have to say, my name's not Bill and I don't live in Phoenix, you know, and I'm not a real estate developer or whatever your story was. Because where else do you meet women but in the casino if you're out playing full time?
That's totally true. And I was in a place where, you know, I was just divorced, so I wanted to meet women. And my initial impression was, you know, I'm going to be out there playing. There's going to be girls. It's going to be fun. It's not really like that. And I got put in a couple awkward positions like that too. I was playing at one casino here in Vegas and started talking with a woman next to me, and she said she owned a nail salon, and I told her I was a investment banker, and we decided to go get a bite to eat, and she's like, I have a confession. I don't really work in a nail salon. I was like, well, I'm not really an investment banker. What do you do? She said, I'm a blackjack dealer. And I said, I was a blackjack dealer. It was pretty funny.
All right, before we get into his next sex stories, we're going to break for some commercials, and then we'll be back with Andrew Yule and Anthony Curtis. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In September, the promotion of the month is the ability to earn up to 3 bottles of South Point 400 commemorative bottles of City Lights Shine, the only legal distillery in Las Vegas. You may earn up to 3 bottles per week at 800 points per bottle. You keep the points. There are 6 flavors to choose among. Week 3 of the 10-week semester of free video poker classes will be on Tuesday, September 17th, starting at noon. The game will be 9-7 double bonus quick quads. I'll be talking more about quick quads in a few minutes. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. Perhaps a big surprise, the game of the week is Quick Quads. Quick Quads is a 6-coin per line game where you get paid for a quad, 4 of a kind, if you get a trip, 3 of a kind, and the other 2 cards add up to the rank of the trips, such as 8-8-8-5-3, or maybe deuce-deuce-deuce-ace-ace. So you get a lot more 4 of a kinds, and you pay 6 coins per line, and you only get paid for 5. So it all adds up. It has a lot of strange plays in it that you don't make in other games. A free copy of strategy is you can find on videopoker.com. It's called A Quick Guide to Quick Quads. I was a co-author of that. Insofar as one of the most fun games to play, Quick Quads ranks up there for me. It is one of the games I physically enjoy playing the most. All right, we're back talking with Andrew Yule and Anthony Curtis. Andrew, when you were having your blackjack career, you were a pretty young guy. It would be reasonable for casinos to insist on seeing your ID to make sure you're at least 21, depending on what state you were in and what the rules were. Now, it is hard to maintain your anonymity when you're forced to show ID. How did this affect things?
It did for sure. I got ID'd a lot. I didn't, you know, I have a beard now. I didn't have the beard back then. I looked like a kid, and I was a kid. I was 24 or 25 or something. And so I through some early experimentation of showing my ID to people that I shouldn't show my ID to, I realized that I needed to be a little bit more careful. So kind of the rule that I used was if the dealer ID'd me when I got to the table, then I would show it to them because they don't care and I just got there. But if somebody came up to me while I was playing and asked for my ID, like a suit or somebody else, then I wouldn't show it. I would say that I left it in the car or whatever.
At which point you have to leave, obviously. If they're outside the pit asking for your ID, then that's probably a sign you need to leave
then
anyway.
Then I'm going to be leaving anyway, exactly. Yeah, they're looking to confirm who I am so they can tell me to leave. So if I just leave without the confirmation of who I am, maybe that preserves me for another session or two, hopefully.
Do you remember when you first knew that you had been flyered, and how did you find out?
I talk about it in the book a little bit. We had a friend, Ken Cho, who had a contact. He had an inside man in surveillance, and we asked him from time to time if there was anything on us, if his friend could check on us in the system. And the first few times there was nothing. You know, we had some pretty big heat situations, and thankfully there was nothing after that. But I remember after one session specifically, one tough weekend that I had here where I got backed off a lot, and he finally let me know that there was alerts on me, and Mark was still in the clear at that point, but apparently I'd attracted a lot of attention at one casino specifically, and they decided to take it upon themselves to make my counting career a little bit more difficult.
So did you hit the road at that point, decide to get out of town?
No, that was when we switched to playing the shoes mostly instead of the double decks. We were playing a lot of double decks at that point, so we kind of restructured our bankroll and our betting system to be able to play shoes. It opened up a lot more casinos that we could play in. You know, not double deck games, good ones are hard to find, and good shoe games are not quite as hard to find. So we just kind of expanded at that point. We did, that was when we traveled to San Diego, but that was kind of our first big road trip. But yeah, sorry.
Isn't that funny how we kind of all started like that, right? Especially back, you know, when we played back in the 80s, 90s, you know, we wanted the single deck. We wanted the double deck, the single deck. You know, Ed Thorpe called it the spectrum of opportunity, right? You know, things would come up and you would have these more opportunities to make big bets. And then we all eventually learned we better start playing shoes, right?
Right.
It's just easier to hide out. You know, it's a lot easier for the floors and the surveillance to run down a double deck, but it's harder for them to get the information when you're playing a shoe. So the fact there's a lot more games and the fact that it's easier to play, it made sense for us to do that.
You know, I wanted to ask about the Cromwell. They've kind of famously gone to looser games, 3-2 blackjack. How has that worked out? Do you think that they are seeing more business, and have you been inundated with card counters because of it?
They've absolutely seen more business. It was a brave thing that they did to attract that kind of player, you know, with the 100 times odds and the affordable single zero roulette and the three to two blackjacks. It was a brave thing because nobody else on the strip is attracting that kind of player. You know, if anything, they're going backwards. They're going the other way, more six to fives and continuous shufflers and
triple zero
roulette, for the love of God. And so it was an interesting move that they made, but they're losing house edge. You know, they're losing a lot, but you attract a certain kind of player. You know, you attract a higher level player. You attract somebody that takes gambling really seriously and doesn't want to play on those other types of games. So it's paid off. The craps action is really big. If you want to play serious blackjack for under $100 on the strip, that's where you go, because you know you can go and play $15 or $25 3-2 games.
That's really an interesting way to put it, though, that you attract a more serious gambler. And you do. I mean, the guy will go and say, but they're still playing negative expectation games.
Right.
They're still going to play single zero at 2.7, but he's a serious gambler. And he is. And I'm not making fun of you. I mean, you're right. These are guys that go, and I want 100 times odds. Well, you're still negative, but you know, but they will do that, and it makes total sense.
I use the term gambler in that sense, and when I say player, I usually refer to guys like us that are playing the game with an edge. But when I say gambler, you know, some people do take losing money seriously. Well, they know they're at a disadvantage, but they want to be at the least amount of disadvantage possible. So they play, you know, the high limit games with the good rules and the 100 times odds, which we see a lot.
They believe in streaks. They believe that they can overcome it if things go their way. And right. If they're not losing too quickly, they're going to have a chance to hit that streak, you know.
If they strike while the iron's hot, they think they can beat it.
Yeah, the big question is, will the lessons learned, you know, make their way to any of the other Caesars properties, you know?
No.
If their revenues are up, but yeah,
it's just kind of a situation that's unique to the Cromwell because of this, we're different than any other casino, just dynamically. You know, we have less rooms, we have less tables. So because of the less rooms, we're not seeing the foot traffic that Caesars has with its 3,500 rooms or whatever it is. We only have 188 rooms. So we have to do something to bring in these types of players. And I think it was a great thing that they did.
Yeah, no, I'm... Yeah,
me too.
Yep.
Well, they're doing the same in video poker. For low stakes, they have a bunch of machines that go up to 99.8%, or at least they did. But you have to play five times as much to earn the same number of reward credits. So they punish you on that end. But for low stakes video poker, if you insist on playing on the strip, it's the place to play. For if you go off strip, there are better places. But for on the strip, and you want to earn Caesar's credit at a slow rate, you can get it there.
That's always how it is, right? If you want to play on the strip, you have to sacrifice a little bit of EV.
No, it isn't always that way. There are times where the strip had the best games for, certainly if you're a $25 player, the strip has the best games. There are a number of places on the strip where you can play high stakes video poker with at least a decent game. And you go to the smaller places and they just don't have any games that are that size. Mm. And if they can reward a place like the Gold Coast, can't do anything for a $125 per hand player that's going to get him excited. I mean, yeah, well, the nicest room at the Gold Coast is not very exciting. The nicest restaurant, I mean, well, Ping Pong Pong is a definitely an interesting place to do. But it's not like some of the places on the strip.
Fair enough.
Now, Andrew, this doesn't have anything in particular to do with the book, but one of our listeners sent us a question and wanted to know about the range of salaries for table game floor people, supervisors, compared to dealers. Do you have anything to say about that?
Sure. I actually did a question of the day on that not too long ago about more specifically about the dealers. And truthfully, the range is so wide, it's hard to put a pin on it. I made maybe $35,000 my first year as a dealer, but there's dealers that make $120,000. So it's just like some of the other things. It depends on where you work and where you are and the type of casino you're in and how they split their tips. That's a big thing. For the dealers, but the floors, I maybe made $40,000 the first year that I did it, and I was making $18 an hour in a small place in Mesquite. But there are floors that make $90,000. You know,
the floors usually share in the tips.
Not anymore. The last place that did that was the Wynn, and they had to stop doing that. That's not a thing anymore.
So if a dealer were to become a floor person, it would normally be a pay cut because they'd get to wear nicer clothes and have more responsibility, but they'd also do it with less money because they don't get the tips. Is that fair?
Not really. It depends on where you are. At some bigger places, that might be the case, but at most places, it pays more and definitely more consistently to be a floor. And the dealers are exposed to the same types of raises that floor supervisors are exposed to. You know, not every company is the same. I can only speak for the different companies that I've worked for. But you know, when you get a cost of living raise at a floor supervisor's wage, it's much different than getting a cost of living wage at a dealer's raise. You know, $7.25, I think, still is minimum wage. And floor supervisors are making, you know, say it's $30 an hour, you know, you get a 4% raise on that, it's much different. So the floors can accrue salary a lot faster than the dealers can. And the dealer's rate is pretty consistent. Like whatever they make within that range almost every year, whereas the floors will make a little bit more and a little bit more every year for the most part.
I think the problem where that comes in is that they're really big places. That they can't, you know, they get a couple of really big high rollers come into the Wynn or Encore, and they're tipping like crazy. And even though they got to split their tokes there, you know, they're going to make more than the floorman's going to make. And you can't pay the floorman enough. And that's why Steve Wynn came up with that idea, that he didn't want the brain drain where all the good people stayed down at the bottom and the people that weren't making as doing as well were going up to the top. And he tried to fix that. I thought it was a pretty good idea, but it never caught on.
Yeah, it was an interesting idea for sure. And the rule is that management can't take tips. That's the rule. So they changed their title of that position to team leader. So their thing was that it wasn't a management position. So that's how they were able to do that for a little while. But Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals came down and said that that's not okay anymore. But at places like that, you're right that the dealer, you know, when the big high limit players come in, they could get a big score where they might make $1,000 in a day, but
that's not available at the smaller joints, so they want to move up to right. boss, right?
Right.
Right. Like, when I was a dealer, everywhere it was better to be a dealer than a boss. You know, even if you were working downtown, the dealers made more than the bosses. I mean, at least the entry-level bosses, not shift managers and
sure,
stuff.
Sure, sure.
But now I think in most places that's changed.
It's definitely evened out, if not reversed. It's hard to put a finger on it because the dealers' incomes are so volatile, right? You know, they might have those $1,000 days that you talked about when the high rollers come in, but they also might have a day where it's dead and they make $50.
Yeah.
Normally that evens out. You know, just take a whatever casino, even if they have their good days and their bad days, that maybe they'll still make $50,000. You know, it usually evens out in the end, whereas the floors have a little more opportunity to kind of steamroll their salaries.
So to keep your own joint, if you were good at it, you never would be a boss.
That's right. Right. I mean, yeah. Depending on the keep your own joint, but at most of the ones I've been to, yeah, for sure, those guys are doing really well.
Well, but the problem there is, you know, like in the old days, crap tables used to go table for table, right? So the crap dealers would include the box man in on the tips. Now they weren't, you know, it was kind of under the table, but it was just like an unwritten rule because now the box man had a vested interest in the dealers making more tips. And the places that go table for table where you keep your own now, you have the problem of dealers paying off bosses. So, you know, if you're not one of the favored dealers, you're stuck on the, you know, the minimum table where you're not going to make anything. And the same people make the money consistently. And
most of the people that I've talked to, the systems are a little bit more fair. Just like they have to hit so many tables in a night. Like they move them from table to table. Right. That still happens. There might be a bad rotation that, you know, if you're not a favorite, that you don't get put on the good rotations. But I think the systems are kind of becoming more in place to kind of take some of that out.
Yeah, I mean, if I owned a casino, there's no way I would allow dealers to keep their own tips. It's too much incentive for stealing to go on. Yeah,
and other things too, right? Yeah. And there's a lot of room for manipulation there. That's actually a kind of a hot topic in gaming right now, and gaming management is, you know, new casinos are popping up all over the country, tribal and untribal, and they're trying to decide how to pay the dealers. How are the dealers going to get paid? And a lot of times the only way to incentivize people to become dealers is to say that they're going to keep their own tips. I've got a friend I'm talking to right now that's going through that exact issue, and she thinks that the only way that she can get, because there's just not enough, there's not interest. In places that don't have casinos, there aren't people that want to be dealers. So it's like a bigger pitch to the deal, to get people to deal if they're going to keep their own tips. It's almost the only way to do it sometimes.
I was waiting for you to say she or her. I knew it would be a female.
Why?
Because the females can take it off the guys better. I mean, a guy, you know, you're not often going to have, what's a guy going to do, come on to a guy in some way? I mean, you don't have that many high-rolling women. You got high rolling guys that come in, and the female dealers. I mean, I know one who's just amazing. amazing. And she flirts with him and nothing ever happens, but they toke her out the, you know, out the door, man. And it, for females, for women who have a chance to keep their own tokes, they can make a lot of money.
The woman I'm referring to is a shift manager that's trying to make the decision, but you're definitely right about that.
Yeah, if your high roller wants a particular female dealer because she has really big eyes, then she's going to do well in those situations. They like big eyes. Now, Andrew, you're Cromwell's part of the Caesar system. Caesars has been sold to Eldorado. At least that's pending. It's expected to go through. Nothing is certain until it actually does. Among Caesars employees, is there any anxiety, worry, enthusiasm for the impending change?
There's not much of anything. Of course, I can only speak for the people that I talk to and deal with every day, but there's not really much of anything. I mean, we all know that the transaction is not going to go through for some time still. And so we've got some time before Eldorado actually takes over. And when they do, I don't think anybody's really anticipating earth-shattering changes at our property. We, you know, there's rumors about this property getting sold or that property getting sold. But just with like today's corporate climate, I guess nobody's really worried about big changes.
Expect to keep their job and to have it more or less the same.
Especially the people around me, because, you know, usually when a new regime takes over and they have a new team that they want to put in, that doesn't affect people at my level or the level below me or even the level above me. It's kind of higher than that. So around me, there's not really any feelings, good or bad.
On last week's show, it was a Bob and Richard Answer Their Mailbag show. And somebody asked Richard that if you were a low-level player just starting out, where would be the best place to play blackjack? And Richard came up with Seattle. Now, you were kind of a low-level player when you played at Seattle. Would you generally agree or disagree with Richard's assessment?
I agree with that. My only question would be bankroll issues, because it's mostly shoe games up in Seattle. I think I played maybe a couple double deck games, but it's mostly shoe games, and you need a bigger bankroll we needed a bigger bankroll for our betting system on the shoes than we did on the double deck games. But Seattle's definitely a good place to play. The heat's low. That was one of my favorite trips that I took was Seattle. The penetration is amazing. It's a great place to play.
The main thing I've heard about Seattle area and Washington and all is all the match play. And I'm telling you, when I first came to town, that's where all this couponomy started, you know, all the stuff in Las Vegas Advisor, coupons and this and that, where I got the idea. I mean, talking low level. We made our bones, man. We made our bones on playing match plays and you know, coupons of different sorts. I've heard that the match play up in that area is just absolutely
amazing. It's killer. It really is. I didn't get a player's card up there, but I saw everybody else around me that had them, and match plays were running the table.
And daily.
Yeah.
You would get like a daily $100 match play. And there's a lot of little casinos, so with small, low minimums. And
absolutely.
When you're really, really getting started, that's gold. That's just gold. I mean, they're so powerful.
That was how I got started in
video. Me too. Raising my hand here, you know.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, we all, and for those of you who don't have color radio, it was his left hand that he was raising. All right. We want to thank Andrew Yule, Anthony Curtis. It's been an informative interview. The new book is called The Blackjack Insiders. It's available now from Huntington Press. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you so much.
It's fun.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.